You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse.
Safer when you're watched. Don't go outside. You'll set the alarm off.
That was Every House a Prison by Jello Biafra and DJ Kioki. The following article was published in the July 7th, 2000 research supplement of the Antifa Online Info Bulletin. The title is U.S. Military Civil Disturbance Planning, The War at Home by Frank Morales. Under the heading of civil disturbance planning, the U.S. military is training troops and police to suppress democratic opposition in America. The Master Plan, Department of Defense Civil Disturbance Plan 55-2, is codenamed Operation Garden Plot. Originated in 1968, the operational plan has been updated over the last three decades, most recently in 1991, and was activated during the Los Angeles riots of 1992, and more than likely during the recent anti-WTO battle in Seattle. Current U.S. military preparations for suppressing domestic civil disturbance include the training of National Guard troops and police, are actually part of a long history of American internal security measures dating back to the first American Revolution. Generally, these measures have sought to thwart the aims of social justice movements, embodying the concept that within the civilian body politic lurks an enemy that one day the military might have to fight, or at least be ordered to fight. Equipped with flexible military operations in urban terrain and operations other than war doctrine, lethal and less than lethal high-tech weaponry, U.S. armed forces and elite militarized police units are being trained to eradicate disorder, disturbance, and civil disobedience in America. Further, it may very well be that police military civil disturbance planning is the animating force and the overarching logic behind the incredible nationwide growth of police paramilitary units, a growth which coincidentally mirrors rising levels of police violence directed at the American people, particularly non-white poor and working people. Possibly illegal, ostensible training scenarios like the recent Operation Urban Warrior, no-notice urban terrain war games, which took place in dozens of American cities, are thinly disguised civil disturbance suppression exercises. In addition, President Clinton recently appointed a domestic military czar, a sort of national chief of police. Ominously, many assume that the training of military and police forces to suppress outlawed behavior of citizens, along with the creation of extensive and sophisticated emergency social response networks set to spring into action in the event of civil unrest, is prudent and acceptable in a democracy. And yet, does not this assumption beg the question as to what civil unrest is? One could argue, for example, that civil disturbance is nothing less than democracy in action, a message to the powers that be that the people want change. In this instance, disturbing behavior may actually be the exercising of one's right to resist oppression. Unfortunately, the American corporate military directorship, which has the power to enforce its definition of disorder, sees democracy as a threat and permanent counter-revolution as a national security requirement. The elite military corporate sponsors of Garden Plot have their reasons for civil disturbance contingency planning. Let's call it the paranoia of the thief. Their rationale is simple: self-preservation. Fostering severe and targeted austerity, massive inequality, and unbridled greed, while shifting more and more billions to the generals and the rich, the deregulated entities of force, and their interlocking corporate directors know quite well what their policies are engendering, namely a growing resistance. Consequently, they are systematically organizing to protect their interests, their profits, and their criminal conspiracies. To this end, they are rapidly consolidating an infrastructure of repression designed to suppress rebellion against their authority, or more conveniently put, to suppress rebellion against the authority of the United States. And so, as the Pentagon Incorporated increases its imperialist violence around the world, the chickens have indeed come home to roost here in America in the form of a national security doctrine obsessed with domestic insurgency and the need to preemptively neutralize it, its code name, Garden Plot. I'm reading from an article by Frank Morales, U.S. Military Civil Disturbance Planning, The War at Home. Origins of Operation Garden Plot, the Kerner Commission. Knowledge makes a man unfit to be a slave. Frederick Douglass. Rochester, New York is a former home of Frederick Douglass' North Star newspaper. In 1964, it erupted in one of the first large-scale urban outbursts of the decade. Precipitated by white police violence against the black community, the July uprising lasted several days, subsiding only after the arrival of 1,500 National Guardsmen. In the fall of 1964, the FBI, at the direction of President Johnson, began to make riot control training available to local police departments, and by mid-1967, such training assistance had been extended to more than 70,000 officials and civilians. On July 29, 1967, President Johnson issued Executive Order 11365, establishing the National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorders. It is more commonly known as the Kerner Commission, named for its chair, former Major General, then Governor of Illinois, Otto Kerner. The creation of the commission came hot on the heels of the violence in Detroit, a conflict which left 43 dead, several hundred wounded, and over 5,000 people homeless. Johnson sent troubleshooter Cyrus Vance, later Secretary of Defense, as his personal observer to Detroit. The commission issued its final report, completed in less than a year, on March 1, 1968. Although the Kerner Commission has over the years become associated with a somewhat benign, if not benevolent, character codifying the obvious "we live in two increasingly separate Americas," etc., the fact is that the Commission itself was but one manifestation of a massive military police counterinsurgency effort directed against U.S. citizens, hatched in an era of emergent post-Vietnam syndrome, coupled with elite fears of domestic insurrection. While the movement chanted for peace and revolution, rebellious, angry, and destructive urban uprisings were occurring with alarming frequency, usually the result of the usual spark: police brutality, white-on-black crime. The so-called urban riots of 1967 through 1968 were the zenith, during this period, of social and class conflict. More than 160 disorders occurred in some 128 American cities in the first 9 months of 1967. The executive order establishing the commission called for an investigation of the, quote, origins of the recent major civil disorders and the influence, if any, of organizations or individuals dedicated to the incitement or encouragement of violence, close quote. The work of the commission was funded from President Johnson's Emergency Fund. The executive order sought recommendations in three general areas: short-term measures to prevent riots, better measures to contain riots once they begin, and long-term measures to eliminate riots in the future. Their two immediate aims were, quote, to control and repress black rioters using almost any available means, quote, and to assure white America that everything was in hand. Commission members included Charles B. Thornton, Chairman and CEO, Litton Industries, member of the Defense Industry Advisory Council to the Department of Defense and National Security Industrial Association. John L. Atwood, President and CEO, North American Rockwell Corporation, Commission Advisor on Private Enterprise. And Herbert Jenkins, Atlanta Chief of Police and President of the International Association of Chiefs of Police. During the early stages of staff recruitment, Commission Deputy Executive Director Victor H. Palmieri described the process as a war strategy, and so he might, given the overwhelming presence within the Commission and its consultants of military and police officials. A key player within the commission, consultant Anthony Downs, stated at the time that, quote, it would be far cheaper to repress future large-scale urban violence through police and military action than to pay for effective programs against remaining poverty, close quote. The Kerner Commission study of civil disorder led directly to civilian recommendations regarding the role of the military in domestic affairs. The report dutifully commends the Army for the advanced status of its training. Further, it states that the Department of the Army should participate fully in efforts to develop non-lethal weapons and personal protective equipment appropriate for use in civil disorders. In addition, the Army should investigate the possibility of utilizing psychological techniques to ventilate hostility and lessen tension in riot control and incorporate feasible techniques in training the Army and National Guard units, end quote. I'm reading from U.S. Military Civil Disturbance Planning, The War at Home by Frank Morales, from the research supplement of the July 7, 2000 Antifa Info Bulletin. And this article was also published in the spring-summer edition of the Covert Action Quarterly. This is quite a long article, so I'm going to skip many of the paragraphs and just conclude with a few final paragraphs which were under the heading of Army Field Manual. United States Army Field Manual 1915, Civil Disturbances, dated November 1985, is designed to provide, quote, hands-on guidance for the commander and his staff in preparing for and providing assistance to civil authorities in civil disturbance control operations, unquote. According to the Army Manual, quote, civil disturbances in any form are prejudicial to the public law and order, unquote. They, quote, arise from acts of civil disobedience, close quote, and, quote, occur most often when participants in mass acts of civil disobedience become antagonistic toward authority, and authorities must struggle to wrest the initiative from an unruly crowd, close quote. They are caused by, quote, political grievances and urban economic conflicts, close quote, or maybe even by agents of foreign nations. But mostly, urban conflicts and community unrest arise from highly emotional social and economic issues, end quote. And in a statement that resonates with the benign neglect of some years ago, the manual points out that disturbances may arise because, quote, economically deprived inner city residents may perceive themselves treated unjustly or ignored by the people in power, close quote. And those were excerpts from U.S. Military Civil Disturbance Planning, The War at Home, from the July 7, 2000 research supplement of the Antifa Info Bulletin. The article was written by Frank Morales. Okay, so the military and the police will crack down if we protest the lack of democracy in our free country in the street. And most of the media is owned by corporations, so we won't hear any criticism there, and we certainly won't be able to say much. But we can still speak our mind on the internet, right? Not for long if corporate America has its way.
Anti-Corporatists Hunted Online by Marcia Stepanek. Businessweek Online, Monday, July 10th, 2000. Beware the public relations person with a modem. Now corporate spinmeisters, too, can go online to track customers, especially the disgruntled ones who vent their spleen in cyberspace. That's right. All those companies you love to hate now have a way to find out who's griping about them, and they can target complainers for a little re-education. Thanks to a new product from Dallas-based eWatch and sold through Edelman Interactive Public Relations Agency and PR Newswire, companies can now monitor what people do or say on the web and respond. The result, so-called anti-corporate activism, as it's known in the flack trade, will never be the same, and neither will your sense of free speech as a consumer. How does it work? Partly, eWatch says, through a little info cleansing. We can neutralize the information appearing online, identifying the perpetrators behind uncomplimentary postings and rogue websites, the company's online promo material says. Then eWatch can remove offending messages from where they appear in cyberspace. This may mean something as simple as deleting a posting from a web message board on Yahoo, or it could mean, quote, the shuttering of a terrorist website, end quote. The objective? Quote, to stop the spread of incorrect information and to ensure what has already spread is eliminated, end quote, eWatch states. Tracking so-called perpetrators is also part of the service, says eWatch National Product Manager Ted Skinner. That's done by, quote, using a variety of methods, such as following leads found in postings and websites, working with ISPs, involving law enforcement, conducting virtual stings, and other tactics, end quote, he says. We can post back to the message boards where original postings appeared to give our side of the story, provide clarification, or debunk it, the eWatch materials go on to say. We can email directly those we think were affected by the incident. And, says eWatch, in the name of identifying entities whose motives are fraudulent, deceptive, or criminal, eWatch CyberSleuth will attempt to identify the entity or entities behind the screen names targeting your organization. Such snoop tools don't come cheap. eWatch says it can identify a person or group behind a screen name that has targeted a particular company or organization within 7 to 10 days for a price of up to $4,995 per screen name. For an extra $1,995 per screen name, eWatch says it can give a company results within 48 hours. Either way, Skinner says, companies that use eWatch, quote, will receive a dossier detailing all information gathered about the subject during the inquiry, end quote. The trouble with all this is that the so-called perpetrators being targeted are often people like you and me exercising our right to free speech. Think about it. You get lousy service from Barnes & Noble, and you criticize it in your favorite chat room. Barnes & Noble, an eWatch customer, could, if it wanted to, monitor that complaint, identify who you are, and get Barnes & Noble's public relations crew to send you an email trying to change your mind. But say you're so angry you write in a posting that you feel like strangling the clerk at the Barnes & Noble store at Union Square in Manhattan because she criticized it in your favorite chat room. Chances are the company would ignore you, but eWatch CyberSleuth wouldn't. It could track you down and forward your name to Barnes & Noble executives for further attention. Or if you're spreading phony tips about Barnes & Noble stock in an online fight in a post, Barnes & Noble could, quote, work with an internet service provider in Square in Manhattan because she criticized it in your favorite chat room. Still not convinced this is for real? eWatch's Skinner says Northwest Airlines used his service earlier this year to help it track down the identities of employees who organized a, quote-unquote, sick out that nearly halted flights over the last Christmas holiday. The company has since fired those employees, and a court has upheld the legality of that action. The ruling is under appeal. Northwest is now using eWatch to help it target, for re-education, the most teed off of its fed-up flyers. To be sure, the net can make it rough out there for companies not used to the consumer scrutiny it enables. According to Skinner, many companies like the employees, and a court has upheld for marketing that action. The ruling is under appeal. The net sometime now using eWatch to help it target. Consider all the websites created by consumers for consumers simply to vent, such as the AetnaSucks.com, AT&TSucks.com, and SearsSucks.com, to name a few. Griping is hardly confined to those sites, Skinner says, and criticisms of companies often shows up in chat rooms or general discussion groups. Say one customer tells their bad experience to 20 other people, and then imagine 50 million people reading about it on the internet, eWatch's marketing materials warn. Adds Skinner, quote, from a public relations standpoint, it becomes much harder to safeguard shareholder value, improve customer service, protect corporate reputation and brand integrity, end quote, when a customer goes online to complain. The net is vast and fast, he says. Besides, Skinner adds, if companies can use the net to personalize customer service, why not use it to do one-on-one public relations? To me, there's something very troubling about cyberspinning. Good public relations personnel can quell panic and remind people of their company's side of the story in the heat of a crisis. But personalized spin campaigns? The potential for abuse seems too high, and the idea sounds ominous to those who cherish free speech without risk of punishment. Even at its most benign, the idea is unsettling. It used to be you could share your opinion about a company with someone online without worrying that the company would ever find out about it. Now you run the risk of getting hassled with corporate email, not to mention being personally targeted for a cyber re-education campaign, or worse. How much will a private citizen say online knowing that? What will happen to online communities that form around a common experience with, say, a lemon of a car or a harmful product? Maybe containment is the whole point, but it's hard to believe that healthy and robust e-commerce, not to mention the right to free speech, can be well served with privacy-busting products like these. If they land in over-aggressive hands, Snoop tools and services like eWatch sound like a PR crisis just waiting to happen.
But I'm a citizen and I have rights. I can have my day in court. That's what the citizens of Wellfleet thought. The Battle of Wellfleet by Jim Boothroyd. Welcome to Wellfleet, population 2500. You're sure to enjoy the excellent library, the 22 museums, the picturesque harbor on Cape Cod Bay. What you won't enjoy are the civil rights you once took for granted. Margot Coach Ruth has helped Wellfleet to rally to Nick's franchise corporations and a cellular telephone tower next to a beautiful waterway. But Coach Ruth got a rude shock last year when she and other residents tried to reject a permit for another cell phone facility. Giant Omnipoint Communications challenged the town council's authority to block the progress of telecommunications. More shockingly, though, Omnipoint claimed that Wellfleet had infringed its civil rights. I highly value that I can say what I think in this country, says Coach Ruth. But on this crucial issue, corporations refuse to listen. The case highlights two trends that have gathered momentum in the last two decades: the narrowing of free speech rights for citizens and the extension of speech rights and other civil liberties to business corporations. Consider Coach Ruth's experience. Last spring, she heard that Omnipoint had applied for a permit to stealth a microwave antenna in the steeple of a church in the center of Wellfleet. Church officials won't say how much they were offered by Omnipoint, but in nearby Brewster, a competing company offered a Unitarian church $50,000 to put an antenna in its tower. The Unitarians rejected the offer. Coach Ruth also discovered a growing body of medical and scientific evidence that suggests electromagnetic radiation emissions from antennas may make people sick. Coach Ruth decided to act. She won a place on the Wellfleet Planning Board and in October cast a decisive vote against Omnipoint's permit application. Wellfleet's town council then called a special meeting. at which 125 residents, a large majority of those attending, voted for a new bylaw that would have forced OmniPoint to site its antenna outside the town. But in December, the town's legal counsel called an emergency meeting. OmniPoint had threatened to sue Wellfleet if it did not immediately grant the permit. The lawyer told the meeting that if Wellfleet denied the permit, OmniPoint would go to court citing the Telecommunications Act of 1996. Section 704 outlaws the regulation by local governments of placement, construction, and modification of personal wireless service facilities on the basis of the environmental effects of radio frequency emissions. Unquote. Excuse me, but I just have to read that line again, because it is outrageous. It said, the lawyer told the meeting that if Wellfleet denied the permit, OmniPoint would go to court citing the Telecommunications Act of 1996. Section 704 outlaws the regulation by local government of, quote, placement, construction, and modification of personal wireless service facilities on the basis of the environmental effects of radio frequency emissions, close quote. Since courts interpret environmental effects as including human health hazards, OmniPoint had the right to site its antennas and towers wherever it pleased. That was bad enough, but many were dumbfounded by what they heard next. The corporation had cited a second piece of legislation in its defense, the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Corporate civil rights sound like an oxymoron, but OmniPoint had case law to back up its claim. In battle just a few months earlier, OmniPoint had convinced a district court judge that the rejection of a cell phone antenna permit by Chadsford Township in Pennsylvania infringed the company's civil rights. The Civil Rights Act was passed to safeguard constitutional and legal rights and to ban employment discrimination by race, religion, and gender. Section 1983 essentially says that any person who causes another person to be deprived of their rights is liable to the injured person. Is OmniPoint an injured person? The company, incorporated in 1987, holds licenses to provide cell phone services in the metropolitan areas of Boston, New York, Philadelphia, and other major cities. Its initial stock offerings in 1996 raised no less than $705 million. In other words, OmniPoint is a sort of corporate behemoth that civil rights are supposed to protect against, not protect. Wellfleet, however, saw a watertight case. In March, its selectmen reversed the planning board decision and gave OmniPoint its permit. Citizens like Coach Ruth are not giving up the fight. They have formed the Wellfleet Action Group, WAG, and continue to oppose OmniPoint and other companies queuing up for antenna permits, Nextel, AT&T, Sprint, MCI, and others. And though OmniPoint has got its antenna in the steeple, its hardline tactics have politicized Wellfleetians. I see this as the ultimate example of corporate power suppressing individual rights, says Lynn Hiller, a member of WAG and a former employee of the National Institute of Health. The fact is that in a lawsuit involving civil rights, we are not equal. And that was The Battle of Wellfleet by Jim Boothroyd. This from the Adbusters website. I recommend you check it out, www.adbusters.org. Well, the government clearly is not for us. So who is it for? That will be the subject of our next presentation by author and political analyst Dr. Michael Parenti, speaking on Who Governs?
Alexis de Tocqueville once said that the wealthy have little desire to govern the working people. They simply want to use them. And yet, members of the owning class seldom have been slow in assuming the burdens of public office. Not every important political leader is rich, but many are, and those who are not are usually beholden to money interests. Not all wealthy persons are engaged in ruling. Many prefer to concentrate on other pursuits like leisure. The ruling class consists largely of the politically active members of the owning class, plus new and faithful recruits from below, such as Ronald Reagan, Richard Nixon, Henry Kissinger, Bill Clinton. All of them came from very modest backgrounds, Lyndon Johnson, but they ended up being millionaires. Helping and serving the rich usually ends up with you yourself being rich. From the beginning of the Republic to modern times, the top leadership positions, including the presidency, vice presidency, the president's cabinet, and the Supreme Court, have rested predominantly in the hands of white males from wealthy families, with most of the remainder being of upper middle class origin, that is, moderately successful business people, commercial farmers, and professionals. Legend has it that many U.S. presidents rose from humble origins. In fact, almost all came from families of a higher socioeconomic status than about 90% of the U.S. population. In recent times, political leaders have been drawn from the directorships of big corporations, prominent law firms, Wall Street banks, and less frequently from the military, elite universities, think tanks, foundations, and scientific establishment. More than a third went to elite Ivy League schools. The men who ran the nation's defense establishment in the decades after World War II were so like one another in occupation, religion, style, and social status that apart from a few Washington lawyers, Texans, and Mavericks, it was possible to locate the offices of all of them within 15 city blocks in New York, Boston, and Detroit. So says Richard Barnett in his book Roots of War. The wealthy carry into public life many of the class interests and values that shape their political careers. For the most part, the plutocracy recruits its top members from its own social class. The crucial factor, however, is not the class origin of leaders, but the class interests they serve. The question is not only who governs, but whose interests and whose agenda are served by who governs, who benefits, and who does not. Government and business elites are linked by institutional, financial, and social ties, and they move easily between public and private leadership posts. One of the most prominent policy advisory groups, which forms an interlocking network of corporate and political notables, is the Council on Foreign Relations, started in 1918 by J.D. Rockefeller, Nelson Aldrich, J.P. Morgan, and other moguls. It consisted primarily of prominent individuals drawn from financial, industrial, and state. The council has some 1,450 members, almost half of whom are listed in the social register. They come from elite families. Almost half of them come from families of inherited wealth. Over 60% are corporate lawyers, executives, or bankers, including representatives from the Rockefeller, Morgan, and DuPont groups. The private companies that have had most council members are Morgan Guaranty Trust, Chase Manhattan Bank, Citibank, and IBM. In recent decades, council members have included U.S. presidents, secretaries of state, defense, cabinet members and their top officers, secretaries of the Army, Navy, and Air Force, members of the Joint Chief of Staff, national security advisors, CIA directors, federal judges, Federal Reserve officers, and scores of U.S. ambassadors and offices of U.S. Agency for International Development and other agencies, scores of U.S. House and Senate members, executives and directors of almost all the major banks and leading corporations. All of these people have been members of the Council for Foreign Relations, including numerous college and university presidents, publishers, editors, newscasters, columnists, and media commentators from every major news organization in the country. The Council on Foreign Relations has played a crucial central role in formulating U.S. foreign policy. It was a major force in creating the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. It advocated a strategic nuclear arsenal, U.S. global interventionism after World War II, military action in Guatemala, military escalation in South Vietnam, and eventual diplomatic relations with China. In 1980, the Council strongly recommended a sharp escalation in military spending and a harder line toward the Soviets. All of these positions I just listed were eventually adopted by whomever was in the White House, regardless of political party. Some Council members also belong to the Trilateral Commission, an assemblage of economic and political leaders from the major industrial countries initiated by David Rockefeller for the purpose of coordinating and protecting international capitalism in a changing world. A similar international organization is the Bilderberg Conference, which each year brings together state leaders, financiers, military commanders, and prominent politicians, along with a sprinkling of academics and publicists from around the world. There's the Business Roundtable. There's the Business Council, the latter composed of 154 representatives from such companies as Chase Manhattan Bank, Morgan Guaranty Trust, General Electric, and General Motors. The Business Council holds regular 3-day secret meetings with top government officials in a posh hotel just outside of Washington, D.C. Rather than promoting the interests of particular enterprises, these various ruling class organizations seek to develop policies to serve the overall system. In other words, they're not lobbyists for General Electric in particular or General Motors in particular. They're there to make the whole system safe for all the Fortune 500. Instead of being special interest lobbyists, they are corporate class policymakers. Their overall influence is drawn from the persuasiveness that inheres in the enormous economic power they wield. Their direct influence is realized in their capacity, which, by the way, is unique among all social and political groups in America, their extraordinary capacity to fill top government posts with persons from their ranks or persons devoted to their interests. The names of the players change, but the game remains much the same. President Ford appointed 14 Council on Foreign Relations members to positions in his administration. 17 top members of the Carter administration were trilateralists, including President Carter himself and Vice President Mondale. President Reagan's administrators included chief executives of Wall Street investment houses and directors of New York banks. At least a dozen of them and 31 advisors were members of the Council on Foreign Relations. Most of President Bush's cabinet consisted of corporate leaders who were also Council on Foreign Relations members and some trilateralists. Bush himself was a former trilateralist. President Clinton's administration offered more gender and racial diversity than was usually found, but not much class diversity, not much political diversity. Clinton's top administrators were drawn from corporate America. Many were Council Foreign Relations members. Now, while still governor of Arkansas, Clinton himself was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. He was a member of the Trilateral Commission, and he was a member of the Bilderberg Conference, having attended the latter in 1991 along with David Rockefeller. Lobbyists also enter the picture. Lobbyists are persons hired by interest groups to influence legislative and administrative policies. Some political scientists see lobbying as part of the information process. So there are some political scientists who are dedicated to seeing a silver lining around every cloud, and anything that happens in the U.S. system is seen as being positive and serving a function. So with lobbyists. The office holder's perception of an issue is influenced primarily by the information provided, and the lobbyist's job is to be the provider. So therefore, this is a very creative and positive process, some observers say. But this process doesn't occur in a social vacuum. Often the arguments made on behalf of an issue are less important than who is making them and what interests he or she represents. Often the information that's supplied is highly skewed to serve a specific interest. It's not there to inform the office holder for the sake of informing him. It's there to win an argument and gain an advantage. As one congressional committee counsel explains it, there's the 23-year-old consumer lobbyist, and then there's the businessman who gives you $5,000. Whom are you going to listen to? Business lobbying has intensified over the last two decades. In 1971, less than 200 firms have registered lobbyists in the Capitol. A decade later, the number had grown to 2,000. By 1979, the American Petroleum Institute, an organization of big, powerful oil, gas, and petroleum and petrochemical companies, was spending $75 million in lobbying efforts. The entire oil industry employed over 600 people to pressure Congress and government agencies. Lockheed, a big defense contractor, currently maintains 135 lobbyists in Washington. Some of Washington's top lobbying groups are well-funded by foreign governments, and these governments are among the world's worst human rights abusers, such as Turkey, Kuwait, Indonesia, Guatemala, Colombia, Saudi Arabia, and the CIA-supported UNITA rebel group, a bunch of murderers in Angola. These governments successfully lobby Congress for hundreds of millions of dollars in foreign aid, complements of the U.S. taxpayer. The most effective resource lobbyists can have at their command is money. Money buys accessibility to the office holder, and beyond that, the opportunity to shape his or her judgments with arguments of the lobbyist's own choosing. Access doesn't guarantee influence. You can get to Washington, and you can find you'll always be politely listened to. As Woodrow Wilson said, they'll listen to you, but the men who were really consulted are the men who have the big stake, the big bankers, the big manufacturers, the big masters of commerce. The masters of the government of the United States are the combined capitalists and manufacturers of the United States. That was former President Woodrow Wilson I was quoting, who said that in 1907. He didn't talk like that after he became president. In other words, it's something more than information flow that determines influence. The decisive factor is not the message, but the messenger. The ability to disseminate information to decision makers and propagate one's cause itself presumes organization, expertise, time, and labor, things that money can buy. In addition, the mere possession of great wealth and the control of industry and jobs gives corporate interests an advantage unknown to ordinary working citizens, for businesses' claims are paraded as the needs of the economy, and as it were, of the nation itself. Having the advantage of pursuing their interests within the framework of a corporate economy, corporate heads can pretty much limit the range of solutions. Surveying the organized interest groups in America, E.E. Schatzschneider notes that the pressure system is largely dominated by business groups, the majority of citizens belonging to no organization that is effectively engaged in pressure politics. So most of us are not represented by the 15,000 lobbyists that prowl the Capitol's corridors and lobbies. In fact, that's where they get their names from, their prowling of the lobbies. These lobbyists, what do? They seek favorable rulings from agencies within the vast executive bureaucracy and from Congress. Lobbyists make themselves so helpful that members of Congress sometimes rely on them to perform tasks that normally are done by congressional staffs. Lobbyists will draft legislation, write speeches, and plant stories in the press on behalf of cooperative lawmakers. Lobbyists put in millions of hours each year to make the world a better place for their clients, and they succeed on a scale that is undreamed of by most ordinary citizens. A favorable adjustment in rates for interstate carriers, a special tax benefit for a family oil trust, the leasing of public lands to a private company, emergency funding for a faltering aeronautics plant, a postal subsidy for advertising firms, the easing of safety standards for a food processor, the easing of pollution controls for a chemical plant, a special acreage allotment for tobacco growers, an investment guarantee to a housing developer. All these hundreds of bills and their thousands of special amendments and the tens of thousands of administrative rulings, which mean so much to particular business interests and arouse the sympathetic efforts of legislators and bureaucrats, will go largely unnoticed in the press, largely unnoticed by a public that pays the monetary and human costs and seldom has the means to make its own case or even to discover that it has a case. Almost all of these special measures are pursued by business. The same business that says we should have less government. It's ironic that business should say it when you think that business is more involved in government than anyone else ever could dream of being. Attempting to speak for the great unorganized populace, public interest groups make many proposals for reform but have few of the resources that push office holders in a reformist direction, especially when their proposals are directed against powerful entrenched interests in the economy. The multiplicity of interests within the business community creates problems of cohesion, but these diverse groups are capable of colluding around common class interests, as I pointed out. Thus we have things like the National Association of Manufacturers and the Chamber of Commerce, where all sorts of various interests collude and get together and back each other's bills against the public interest. Pressure group efforts are directed not only at office holders, lawmakers, and bureaucrats, but also at the public itself in what's called grassroots lobbying. The goal is to create a general publicity campaign and media blitz to influence the lawmakers' sense of what should be done. The contest is a highly unequal one. Corporations and business associates have been able to spend over $1 billion a year on grassroots lobbying, whereas the combined expenditures of environmental, consumer, and other public interest groups comes to less than 1% of that amount. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce alone, with its thousands of associated businesses and $67 million annual budget, can bring down a snowstorm of mail and a mountain of pressure on lawmakers. In the summer of 1993, the National Association of Manufacturers launched a campaign that inundated Congress with letters and phone calls opposing President Clinton's proposed energy tax, and as a result, the plan was squashed. Interest groups sometimes hide behind front organizations that have uplifting public service-sounding names. For instance, the National Wetlands Coalition is a well-financed lobbying of giant oil companies, mining companies, and real estate developers with the mission of undoing the regulations that protect our wetlands. They should be called the National Anti-Wetlands Coalition. Some grassroots lobbying is intended to build a climate of opinion favorable to the corporate giants, rather than to push a particular piece of legislation. The steel, oil, and electronics companies do not urge the public to support the latest tax loophole bill or business handout. I mean, if anything, they would prefer that citizens not trouble themselves with such matters. But they do educate the public, telling of the many jobs they create, the progress and services they provide, the loving care they supposedly give to the environment, and all of this. This is called institutional advertising. It could also be called grassroots ideological lobbying. It's an attempt to place the desires of the giant firms above politics and above controversy and above control, a goal that is itself highly political. Rather than selling their particular products, the corporations sell the business system itself. Besides working the inside track of influence peddling, business does well in mass campaigns, using the power of money to harness the power of numbers. On occasion, progressive groups in various states are able to place referenda on the ballots supporting reform causes. Polls show that often these referenda are initially backed by large majorities, only to be voted down after public opinion is swayed by multi-million-dollar media assaults launched by affluent interests. Increasingly, the referendum is being successfully employed by well-funded conservative organizations utilizing newspaper advertisements, radio and TV commercials, and using hundreds of millions of dollars to buy the time. We hear that the trouble is the unions are causing a lot of our trouble, and unions have been too strong. For years, conservatives would tell us that labor unions are corrupt, unpopular, harmful, and too powerful. The truth is something else. In 1947, a Republican-controlled Congress passed the Taft-Hartley Act, which imposed restrictions on strikes, boycotts, and labor organizing, resulting in a decline in union membership from 35% of the workforce to 16% by 1991. The number of strikes has dropped drastically as weakened unions have become less able to fight back. Union busting has become a major industry, with more than 1,000 consulting firms doing a $500 million business every year, teaching companies how to prevent workers from organizing and how to get rid of existing unions. Industry also uses the threat of plant closings to extract from unions benefits and wage concessions amounting to billions of dollars. Under federal law, the National Labor Relations Board is an independent federal agency intended to protect labor's right to organize and deal with grievances against management. During the Reagan-Bush years, the NLRB was stacked with pro-business appointees who often refused to protect employees from being illegally fired from union activities, and who would impose only token fines on management for serious violations. During union election drives, Management can propagandize workers as a captive audience and ply them with gifts to induce an anti-union vote. In contrast, union organizers are denied access to the worksite and are prohibited from giving gifts to workers. Management can threaten to move the plant if a union is voted in. About 10,000 workers a year are illegally fired for their union organizing activities. The NLRA right to organize, guaranteed under federal law, has become almost a dead letter. A company caught threatening a worker with dismissal for union activity suffers the heavy penalty of having to post a notice promising not to do it again. Throughout the 1980s and early 90s, owners have refused to negotiate contracts with unions. They've deliberately forced workers out on strike. When this happens, the company fires the strikers and brings in permanent replacements to break the union. This is why strike activity has fallen markedly. The threat of scab worker replacement, in effect, has eliminated the right to strike and seriously hampered the right to unionize. If unions are in decline, and they are in decline, 34% of the workforce was unionized in the 1950s. Today, it's down to about 15 or 14%. If they're declining, it's not because workers don't like them. By a margin of 60 to 23%, Americans believe unions have been good for working people. Almost 4 out of 5 citizens favor laws that would protect the right of workers to organize. The causes of decline are the repressive, one-sided conditions under which organized labor has been forced to operate. Far from having too much power, unions have been fighting for their lives. Some people complain that unions are corrupt and undemocratic. To be sure, some union leaders become union dealers, powerful and autocratic in relation to their own membership, voting themselves sumptuous salaries and colluding with gangland thugs to intimidate rank and file. And in return, they win management's ready acceptance as a union because they do very little for the membership and they cooperate with management. But this kind of corruption tends to be concentrated in less than 1% of all locals. In contrast, 60% of the Fortune 500's largest corporations have been guilty of fraud, bribes, illegal kickbacks, tax evasion, and other criminal acts. Business also plays fast with labor's money. During the 1980s, almost 2,000 companies removed $21 billion from employees' pension funds and stole additional billions by substituting inferior pension plans for the ones that workers had originally paid into. If unions are bad for the economy, we might expect that as they decline, the economy would flourish. But the very opposite has happened. Organized labor has lost membership from 1970 to 93, but there has been no great economic resurgence. Instead, there were several severe recessions. In states where unions have been traditionally weak, Alabama, South Carolina, and Mississippi, the standard of living has been lower than in states where unions have a strong presence. And so with the third world countries that have weak or non-existent unions as compared to the better unionized and more prosperous nations of Western Europe and Scandinavia. Unions correlate with prosperity rather than with poverty. Human labor is the basis of our well-being and survival. Everywhere in the world, in the United States, it deserves far better treatment than it is getting.
You heard Who Governs? Part 8 of a 12-part series of commentaries by Michael Parenti. Michael Parenti is author of many books, among them Democracy for the Few, Inventing Reality, Against Empire, and Dirty Truth.
For more information on Michael Parenti's work, check out his website at www.michaelparenti.org.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us through our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. You can also download shows you may have missed or get more info on the topics covered. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
We'll always be filled by Unwelcome.